This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Dorothy Bradley. She's wildlife and wilderness advocate. She was a former eight-term state representative in the Montana State Legislature, and she now resides in Clyde Park, north of Livingston. At age 23, she helped organize Montana's first Earth Day observance, and she's a longtime advocate for citizens to have a clean and healthful environment. Bradley also was at the forefront of movements for women's rights, conservation, and clean water policy in the state. So welcome, Dorothy. It's good to be talking to you. I want to hear about your history in Montana, fighting for the environment.
I'm honored to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
You recently wrote an article in which you talked about stewardship. That's a really conservative idea. How about talking about that? How does that idea come about?
I was contemplating stewardship because a friend said to me in friendly banter, you know, you're just one of those people who wants to get in the state and really appreciate it, enjoy what it gives, and lock the door behind you so that no one else can come in. And I thought, I've heard that before. I've heard that even from people running for public office, so we can't just keep people out and use it for ourselves. And I thought, that doesn't fit with what I was raised with. I was raised with the concept of stewardship. And that is, it is your obligation to take care of what you have and pass it on. It isn't just your luxury to use it and use it, but it's you being held accountable to the future. And to be so lucky to be here is also to be responsible for carrying it forward. I had an interesting read recently with a book called Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which made me think about our whole concept of stewardship and the land. And in that book, the indigenous elder tells the author, he says, you know, there are some things so different about our cultures. For example, you believe that you can buy and sell property. We couldn't possibly believe in that. To think of buying and selling property or land would be like buying and selling our grandmother. It's just not in our human perspective. And I thought that's really interesting and also a little bit scary because it tells us that our perspective of stewardship and the land is very much a taught and learned behavior. And our obligation to pass on high-quality landscapes is not just to pass on the land itself, but to pass on this whole sense of stewardship, or we'll fail. I had it imbued at a very young age. My father in Bozeman was a geologist at MSU. We were camping before I could walk, and it was imbued in us that we would leave a campsite pristine. Yeah. That meant you couldn't tell we had been there, not a sign of a tissue or a piece of char from a campfire. And that stayed with me just as a matter of you know, personal conduct. And then when I was just out of college, my mother was dying of cancer. And my family had her at the hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. And an older woman came by and left us with a copy of a book called Sand County Almanac.
Yeah.
As it turned out, this incredible book, Creating the Land Ethic, was written by Aldo Leopold, and she was Aldo Leopold's widow, Estella.
Really?
And Aldo had been one of my dad's professors at UW. And we read aloud that book around her hospital bed, and we were mesmerized. And for me, it was like, thank goodness somebody has put all of these things into words.
Uh-huh.
It's my moral code, and it's called the land ethic, and it means your responsibilities are not just to humankind, but the greater land community itself. And so when you both experience this in your youth and you're taught it by your best teachers, your parents, and then you read what this really means, that's to me where the sense of stewardship comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And it is deep and it is important. I might say that as a final stamp of approval, it's really very much stated in Montana's constitution that was written and passed by Montanans in 1972. So through and through, we're a stewardship state.
Oh, mm-hmm. I think you need to remind the governor of that.
Well, hopefully all of us will find it sooner or later. I tend to believe that one thing we all do is dearly love the beautiful landscape of Montana. Nobody has a private corner on it. We all love it, and we just have to think through a little bit better and work together a little bit better to make sure we don't ruin it.
Well, Montana is one of the fastest-growing states, and particularly around Bozeman to the west. How does your stewardship theory apply to that?
As we're speaking, I can hear the sandhill cranes making a lot of noise. I think the junior sandhills are growing up right now and possibly learning to fly. So
that's great.
We hear a lot of sandhill language. That's the bird of my soul, if there ever was one. The Gallatin Valley and the Gallatin Canyon, I think we all know in our heart of hearts, cannot possibly accommodate the use that everyone wants out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you find out what is the optimal carrying capacity of a piece of land, but looking up the canyon, when you find green algae in the most incredibly fabulous stream in the whole state, the West Gallatin, when you find it green with algae, you know we're doing something wrong, and it is all our responsibility to figure it out.
Right.
And just to, you know, carry that visual a little bit further, but I'll never forget, maybe about 4 years ago, I went skiing with a friend on the cross-country skiing on the golf course at Big Sky, and he said, you've got to come over here and see this camos and this little stand of willows. A little stand of willows was about the size of your kitchen, and he said, what a beautiful sight. I think it was on that person's porch last week. And, you know, I couldn't help myself. Sometimes I say more than I should, and I said, I find no beauty in this situation. When I was so lucky to be young and to work at the 320 guest ranch up this canyon, This whole valley had no houses and had no golf courses. And these animals had the whole range to feed, to drink, to calve, to roam, to find corridors, to find food. And to tell you the truth, I've never been back. I thought, I can't stand the heartbreak of seeing these animals absolutely squeezed out.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be letting that happen. We should be doing everything in our power in this huge part of the United States of America to protect these last extraordinary wild animals, unless we really want to try to turn it into a little piece of postage stamps here and there, feeding the animals to keep them alive, which is no one's idea of a large, resilient animal population.
All right.
As far as where I live in the Shields Valley, and I came over here, I have to say, as an escapee. I didn't want to see the sadness I felt at losing all that ag land in the Big Gallatin, that extraordinary valley, which I might say is probably going to lose its water because it's going to be more seriously usurped from Gallatin development if we keep letting it happen. Just next door to me, up over the hill where I can't quite see it, this most beautiful ranch has existed, the Crazy Mountain Ranch. My partner of 30 years is a retired rancher, and he always called it the most perfect integrated ranch he had ever seen, meaning you can grow your cows, you can winter them, you can grow your hay, harvest it, you have pasture, you have everything. and it is now sold to yet one more stringer out of the Yellowstone Club.
Oh, my.
And what are they doing this summer? They're building a huge golf course.
Oh, my.
Now, I'm not going to dwell on the road.
Yeah.
They have wrecked a bridge and two roads already with gravel trucks.
Oh.
It's the most hideous thing I've ever seen. They've worn this gravel road with farmers living on it right down to the huge boulders that are the undergirth of the gravel road, but to build a golf course. And it reminded me of a pretty amazing article I read recently about Sicily and the Mediterranean drought, where in Portugal, for example, they're having to close down orange groves, and in Sicily, they've sold off huge numbers of their cattle because it's so dry, there's such a serious drought, they can't grow grass. And goat herds are dying because they're drinking water out of mud holes.
Oh, jeez.
And all they're doing now to protect their economies is cater to tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So that while agriculture is dying out in these places, tourists are not being rationed even in showers at hotels or in golf courses. And it reminded me of a golf course up here in a huge dry swath of the Shields Valley. And I thought, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see this is not a sustainable model. You can't keep building for more and more expensive tourism and more expensive landowners and crowd out agriculture. That's a bad scenario.
Right. Yeah, I've called you because a friend told me that you've been critical of the Gallatin Forest Partnership, which presents itself as a broad coalition of interests. There was a recent meeting held by the partnership itself to present their plan for the Gallatin Range. Can you comment on that?
Well, I decided to go to one of the three touted, well-advertised public meetings. I went to the one in Livingston and heard a very nice, sweet presentation from two of the partner interests, which were bikes and backcountry horsemen. And I have to say, I have a lot of respect for both those interests and both those sports. But powerfully little information was disclosed. And then I discovered, looking under the rug, it's really hard to come by information. It's hard to find out exactly what this proposed Conservation and Recreation Act, which they say is official, it's hard to find out what the wording is. And I got up to just say there's, you know, an alternative perspective about the Gallatin. And I was closed down. At first, the mic was taken away, and I stood up on a picnic table bench. I thought, well, I've got a pretty powerful voice. And then they turned up the music on me. And to this day, I'm not angry. I'm just dumbfounded. You know, it was one of the funniest things that ever happened to me. Suddenly, I'm drowned out by music, and I'm looking around thinking, well, this is really odd when you're 77. But that's how it went. So, you know, I've delved a bit more into that issue to find out what the real proposal is. And that's a long and complicated discussion of its own. We can get down into the weeds about acres of the wilderness study area and little acres taken here and there elsewhere for wilderness and whether it really protects, permanently offers protection when there's all these other labels like intensive recreation. But my biggest central thought at this point, since I've watched it for at least 3 or 4 years, is that this proposal and partnership never factored in climate change. And, you know, even that many years ago, while it was on the radar of many of us, it wasn't on the radar of the public. Well, it is now. You hear every day, every hour on the news about something new about climate change and how it's worsening problems of ocean warming and melting glaciers and rising sea levels and everything else. And there's so many things going on. Climate change, you can look through the whole study. You can look through all their language, and it's barely a footnote. But what a tragedy. We who are working on these issues right now have at our fingertips the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment.
Mm-hmm.
It was put together over great time and with great scientific caution. by MSU scientists, by Idaho State University scientists, by USGS. And it's not just that we have to think about what's going on in a global sense. We have information at our fingertips about exactly what is happening here. And it's happening so fast, you could almost measure it by the year. It has three main messages. There is less rain. There are hotter temperatures. And the peak runoff every year gets earlier and earlier. Those are things we can factor in as we assess what we have to do to protect, frankly, species in the Gallatin and Madison range that are, in anyone's book, in danger of becoming extinct. It's information at our fingertips, and it's done locally. We don't have to think what is going to happen globally. We know right now what is going to happen as we think of adaptive management and other strategies of climate refuges as all the tools that are our fingertips to try to protect the whole community here, the wild community. There is information and new tools every day that are being considered. And to put a recommendation before Congress that hasn't factored in climate, to me, is really unworthy of who we are as the stewards of this piece of land.
Was there anyone else who attempted to delve into the GYRCA, the Act, at that meeting? Did they shut anyone else down?
Well, there was no point in anyone else talking after I was shut down. They had a comment from the Greater Yellowstone Coalition and then comments from the backcountry horsemen and from the bikers. And, you know, I like these people. I want to work with them. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's room for all of us still.
Uh-huh.
I just don't think it has to be in the last little wild ranges of the Gallatin Madison. I continue to believe we all care so deeply about this landscape. We can find ways to better protect it. It can bring us together. It doesn't have to split us apart. But that proposal really falls short.
Was it the Gallatin Forest Partnership? Who were the members of it?
Well, the people that were there, and I know they have a lot of members,
uh-huh.
The people that were there were the Gallatin, the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, the Wild Montana, which used to be, in my day, the Montana Wilderness Association,
uh-huh.
And the Wilderness Society. I mean, my father was a founding member of the Montana Wilderness Association.
Right.
I grew up with these extraordinary people working to create wilderness, like Lee Metcalf, like Lincoln Scapegoat and Cecil Garland, which taught me, if nothing else, that every single person's voice matters in this. Some of these things would never have happened. And, you know, I'll carry that message on with the legislature, because when we were implementing the extraordinary Montana Constitution, during the entire 70s, we had leaders in the legislature in both parties working together to pass the most visionary legislation that this state has ever seen when it comes to land stewardship.
I've heard that there are some commercial interests that are going to benefit from the proposed act that they put together. Do you know anything about that?
Oh,
logging or—
you know, I'm so used to the innovativeness of Montanans and Americans to make money off of whatever.
Yeah.
And of course, there are all these outdoor recreation entities, and some of the winter bikes now have studs in their tires, and, you know, you can take the most polluted mountain water and put it through a squeeze bag and get pristine water. I don't regret these things going on, and in its own way, it creates somewhat a love of the landscape. What we have to think more about is how we don't use up the resource that we love. And we're just on the verge of doing it. You know, this is our last chance to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
If the wilderness is gone now, you don't bring it back. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
And to have this new proposed act not even include the name wilderness is kind of heartbreaking, because all of those who helped work so hard to set aside the WSAs, the Wilderness Study Areas.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get it all done in their day, so they've given us this opportunity. And, you know, I don't want that opportunity just to turn this piece of beautiful country into a recreation playground. We have so much space out there for recreation. It doesn't have to be where the last Wolverine lives. It doesn't have to be that last piece of land.
Right. Good point. So would you like to see the Gallatin Range designated as a national wilderness?
I wouldn't put myself in position of making that kind of decision at this point. What I would really like at this point, I think, are two things. One, to do another study with real wildlife biologists and climatologists to look at this piece of land we have still at our fingertips and give us a better sense of where the critical corridors are, where the migration takes place, where critical calving takes place, where the most critical feeding is, and what is going to happen with this early spring runoff of the water and the more, you know, like the dying of the white pines and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to help that persist as a viable, sustainable wild resource? I'd like that study done. And if we can be this deep into climate change where we hear about it every hour and not take a year out to make that effort, then it's really tragic. The second thing is we have these wilderness study areas. People complain bitterly because the Forest Service hasn't regulated use the way they should. They're supposed to be managed as wilderness. And, you know, even like take the Lionhead, they're not. And in some cases, the Forest Service seems to have accommodated the use by even making more trails. Well, I think that we could come together and say, how do we protect these WSAs? How do we rewild or restore them and help the animals at their huge moment of need when this planet's getting hotter? You know, what can we do to help those WSAs and renew our effort to take advantage of this opportunity of creating more wilderness that the predecessors, the people who created the WSAs, they gave this to us. It's our responsibility to do better with it than what we're doing at the moment. We can do better, and the public in the future deserves better.
What I heard is that there is a Yellowstone climate agreement. Were you involved in putting that together?
I don't know anything about the climate agreement.
Oh, okay.
I only know about the climate assessment. I've looked it over, and I've studied some of the details. And the ones I've retained is it's going to get hotter, there's going to be less snow, and the runoff is earlier. And those are three easy factors that we can consider.
Mm-hmm.
You can be sure that everybody else is. You know, farmers are considering how to deal with that. Certainly, forest managers can figure out how to deal with that when the number one priority is the wildlife and the well-being of the river communities, the water communities.
You live just across the valley from the Crazy Mountains. Are the Crazy Mountains, are they being invaded in any way?
Well, everything is being invaded. Of course they are. And it will get more serious with the McMansions they plan to build with the Crazy Mountain Ranch owned by the Stringer from the Yellowstone Club. We can see ahead, and it's nothing but more pressure. But the Crazy Mountains are extraordinarily special. And if we can find a way of thinking new about protecting the Crazy Mountains, that would be so remarkable. I think the Forest Service proposal for wilderness up there is like 10,000 acres. Well, my God, just the fire they had 3 years ago in the Crazy Mountains was 12,000. And think about the fire down in California, the Park Fire, 400,000, I think it's up to. I mean, 10,000, let's not fool ourselves. That's a joke. But these mountains have the most amazing Indian culture in them,
mm-hmm.
which could be at the center of their protection. I mean, here, not too far from the Crazies, we have the Clovis Child. What is it, 12 or 14,000 years old?
Right.
One of the oldest sites of human habitation in this part of the world. And there are, like, ancient tepee rings and bison wallows, migration paths. Oh, and of course, to mentioned Plenty Coup, This is where young Plentiku, later chief of the Crow Indians, or Absulika, had his vision quest. It's just a young boy walked up in those mountains and finally, in desperation to have his vision, cut off the end of his finger and made himself bleed so that he would see his vision, which amazingly led to his focus and of his Indian community on education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, education that the Chickadees provided him insight on. And there's so many different things we can do. I mean, we can think, it's a wonderful thinking point. Let's get innovative. There's monument status. There are a lot of people now are thinking about permanent national climate refuges. Well, we're going to need some climate refuges. We know that. This is not going to get better before it gets worse. And this would be the year to do that. One of my favorite stories, and we're celebrating the 75th birthday this year, is Wag Dodge and the Fire in Man Gulch.
Nope.
That's really a personal one to me because those men who were killed were working for my partner's father, who was in the Forest Service in White Sulphur the very day. They were shipped out, sent to Missoula, got on their garb, went to Man Gulch, and then perished. But Wag Dodge, going up that gulch, suddenly saw the fire was going to engulf them, and none of the old traditional remedies worked. So he looked it over and decided on the spur of the moment that he had to light an escape fire. He lit a fire up ahead of him, which went up the hill, stepped into it, put a bandana on, laid down in the scorched earth, and he was the only, one of the few that survived. And now, you know, escape fires is one of the regular tools that are incorporated by firefighters.
Oh, I read that.
Keep thinking that. We've got to remember that today. Think new. We're up against forces that we've never dealt with before. We have to think new in how to survive and to survive better and help the land community survive along with us.
You know, I read that book, Young Men in Fire, which tells the story of the Man Gulch fire, and that rings a bell with me. That's very good. So, are there changes in how long have you lived in the Shields Valley?
Over 20 years. But I lived in Bozeman. I've lived in Montana really essentially my whole life.
Are there wildlife changes that you've seen in the Shields Valley since you moved there?
There are changes that you can see, and then your instincts tell you there are other changes on top of it. And I have to say, I mourn the loss of the ranch community. Ranches do such a service keeping land open and useful.
Uh-huh.
And I feel very protective of ranchers. But you see more and more when they are offered millions upon millions to sell out to people who are under the pretense of being ranchers for a little bit and then want to do exclusive, fancy things that the wealthy only can do. I regret that. I don't want Montana to lose its personality of a beautiful place for everyone.
Yeah. Well, Dorothy, we have run our half hour, so we're out of time.
I will just conclude by thinking we all ought to be thinking more about what we want Montana to be known as, what we want our beautiful state to be recognized for. And I still always come down to I want it to be known as the state with a beautiful and profound constitution and some of the most visionary legislation that was ever passed. And then maybe we can come a little closer to Wallace Stegner's comment to us, if you can create good policy, then you will have a state that matches its beautiful scenery.
That's
been the vision ever since he wrote it down.
Uh-huh. Well, great. That's very thoughtful. Dorothy, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
A pleasure to have the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Okay. Our guest today has been Dorothy Bradley, wildlife and wilderness advocate, who was a former eight-term state representative in the Montana State Legislature. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can also visit our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.